Hey guys, how's things? Oh yeah? Right on. Okay. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. My beasties are in stereo, but they're out of balance, I can tell. Hope that still sounds good in your ears. Alright. Well, good show for you today, because I got Patrick Coburn's phone number. Even better, I got his Skype. So maybe we'll get some good quality audio out of Patrick. Definitely we're going to get some some high quality foreign policy analysis for you. This time on the issue of Bahrain. Guilty. I plead guilty to, criminal negligence. When it comes to Bahrain issues. I mean, I'm good on Bahrain. And I've had a few interviews here and there on Bahrain. But since it's all my government's responsibility, and the government is ostensibly mine, I owe it to the slaves of Bahrain to criticize my government on their issue more often and more thoroughly. It's a tyranny, and America owns it. The American Empire does. Anyway, Patrick Coburn's going to be on the show to talk about that. And then, I don't know if I got email cooties or what the hell. You know, the other Scott Horton told me at one time took him recently. Took him 2 weeks to get an email from me. Or a week and a half or something. And I thought, well, that's a long time for an email to take to get somewhere. He's probably a lot more likely to be getting intercepted than me, really. But, yeah, who knows what happened to it. I took a left turn at Albuquerque. Where the cops will shoot you. Look out. But anyway, I got a bunch of emails out, so maybe we'll hear from Bandow, and maybe we'll hear back from, oh, I guess the ACLU ain't going to show. And I'm trying to get this, one lady wrote a thing about Nigeria that was really good. I can't remember her name. And then I'm also trying to get somebody on about Ukraine. Where the hell is everybody today? I got a hold of Brendan O'Neill, but he couldn't do the show. But man, he wrote a great old thing about Nigeria that I hope everyone will read. It'll be the spotlight on antiwar.com tomorrow. And that should be fun. And, yeah, you know, I don't know. I got a lot of news to complain about. I guess I can take some phone calls, too, if you guys want to do phone calls. Hey, chat room guys. Someone in the chat room saying hi. How's it going? If you want to join up the chat room, it's myname.org. ScottHorton.org/chat. And you could use Pigeon or Chatzilla or whatever the hell if you want. It's a IRC free node chat, but you can just use a plain old browser window. ScottHorton.org/chat. Fill out a CAPTCHA and a fake name and you're in there. So that's good. That is bad. I am hitting a button here. I have been informed. Oh, what the hey? God dang it, Bobby. I've been informed that my clock is wrong. Should not be wrong. But it is wrong. So, let me get that fixed. Yeah, all right, anyway. Yeah, and I got lots of bad news. Ukraine, Syria, Israel, etc. How much time I got? I still got a few minutes here. Well, let me talk about Ukraine a little bit here. I think, you know, if I could be so bold as to advise the empire, I think that huffing and crossing your arms and stamping your feet and saying, we refuse to recognize the legitimacy of the elections in eastern Ukraine, is actually counterproductive propaganda and psychological operations wise and all of that. Because here's the thing. Everybody knows you backed a group of Nazis who overthrew an elected government. So for you to criticize the legitimacy of this election, that election, or any election in Ukraine ever, but especially right now, is null and void and revoked. You're out of order, America. Shut up. You're just making the pro-Russian separatists look more legitimate in comparison to your bloody hypocrisy. And I don't mean bloody like damn the way the Brits say it. I mean soaked in the blood of dead innocent people. And you know, by the way, man, god dang, dude, you guys need to be reading Robert Perry. And I apologize, it's my fault. I gotta accept responsibility for my own damn behavior here. What happened was Robert Perry wrote the dumbest thing a liberal ever wrote about libertarians. And you know how liberals, they just don't understand libertarians. They think libertarians are to the right of the worst right-winger, right? So if Obama put the right sector Nazis in power in Ukraine, well then libertarians are somewhere to the right of that even or something. Because liberals are stupid. They're stupid. They don't understand things. Not really. And so Robert Perry wrote this, you know, like all those alternate and salon.com articles about the dreaded fear libertarianism. Well, Robert Perry wrote one at Consortium News that was the worst of them all. That said that all of us, you know, libertarians say things that sound like things that Thomas Jefferson said, and everybody knows that Thomas Jefferson just wanted to be free so that he could rape his slaves in peace. And so, aha, libertarians just want white supremacy and, in fact, even chattel slavery, says Robert Perry at Consortium News. So, I fired off an email telling him, you stupid idiot, how could you be so stupid to think that? If that's true, then how come you're friends with us then? I guess you want to be a slave master too, Mr. Racist, black person hating slavery monger. What the hell are you talking about? I asked him, did you have a stroke or something? In other words, I unfriended Robert Perry. I gave him the worst middle finger I could by way of email. Which was stupid, because, as you guys know, libertarianism isn't my issue. I mean, I'm a libertarian. And my patience will only bend so far. But in the case of Robert Perry, I should have just ignored that stupid thing. Because he doesn't even write about stuff like that. Occasionally he'll write something about some bankers and how there ought to be more welfare or whatever. But mostly he writes about foreign policy stuff. And mostly the corruption of the Republicans. He's not nearly as hard on the Democrats, I know. But he's no kook, and he's really good on the Republican stuff. Ever since the days of Ronald Reagan arranging for the Lebanese to hold the American hostages longer. And the Iranian... the Lebanese hostages was later. The Iranian hostages longer. So that it would cost Jimmy Carter the election in 1980. He's been good on this stuff ever since then, all the way through Iran Contra, and great during all the Bush Jr. years, on hates neocons, pals around with Ray McGovern, you know. He can tell the difference. He's a liberal who can tell the difference between a neocon and an oil man. Hey, all right, discernment. I'll take it. But anyway, that's my excuse. As shoddy as it is, that's my excuse for not interviewing Robert Perry 3 times a week over the past months. And he writes every day about Ukraine over there at consortiumnews.com, and it's great stuff, man. I mean, it is 4-star material here. This one is called Burning Ukraine's Protesters Alive. And part of what makes this journalism special is that he stands almost alone, really. Well, that's not really true, but... You know, certainly TV rules the narrative. And, you know, all the most acceptable political writers in America, foreign policy writers in America, are mostly inside the acceptable lines here. And Perry just nukes those lines. You know, oh, we all love the coup d'etat of February. The only question is how best to reintegrate the East under Western control. And this is what they'll argue about on CNN. And Robert Perry just absolutely will not let up on America's Nazis in Ukraine. Yeah, Nazis. Oh, no, they're not the National Socialists. They're the Social Nationalists. And no, they don't have SS lightning bolts. They have the Volsen swastika, or whatever the hell it's called. The Volsangle, which is actually, yes, their logo left over from the Ukrainian division of the Waffen-SS. Of the German Gestapo. The proud Banderists. The proud Nazis of Western Ukraine. The Svoboda. The Freedom Party. Oh no, we're not the Social Nationalists. Much less National Socialists, you know. We're the Freedom Party now. Svoboda. And never mind all those 88s and Iron Crosses and Hitler's salutes. And then the right sector's even worse. I'm going to get back into this article on the other side of this break. They keep burning people to death, Waco style over there, these Nazis, these American-backed Nazis in Ukraine. Oh, the shame! You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, I got to read fast here because I got a lot more to cover. There's been elections over the weekend and everything, but I just want to read to you this Robert Perry here in case you're not going to get around to it. ConsortiumNews.com. Burning Ukraine's protesters alive. In Ukraine, a grisly new strategy, bringing in neo-Nazi paramilitary forces to set fire to occupied buildings in the country's rebellious southeast, appears to be emerging as a favored tactic as the coup-installed regime in Kiev seeks to put down resistance from ethnic Russians and other opponents. The technique first emerged on May 2nd in the port city of Odessa, where pro-regime militants chased dissidents into the trade union's building and then set it on fire. As some 40 or more ethnic Russians were burned alive or died of smoke inhalation, the crowd outside mocked them as red and black Colorado potato beetles with their chant of "Burn, Colorado, burn." Afterwards, reporters spotted graffiti on the building's walls containing swastika-like symbols and honoring the, quote, Galician SS, the Ukrainian adjunct to the German SS in World War II. This tactic of torching an occupied building occurred again on May 9th in Mariupol, another port city, as neo-Nazi paramilitaries, organized now as the regime's National Guard, were dispatched to a police station that had been seized by dissidents, possibly including police officers who rejected a new Kiev-appointed chief. Again, the deployment of the National Guard was followed by burning the building and killing a significant but still undetermined number of people inside. Early estimates of the dead range from 7 to 20. In the U.S. press, Ukraine's National Guard is usually described as a new force derived from the maiden self-defense units that spearheaded the February 22nd revolt in Kiev, overthrowing elected President Viktor Yanukovych. But the maiden self-defense units were drawn primarily from well-organized bands of neo-Nazi extremists from Western Ukraine, who hurled firebombs at police and fired weapons as the anti-Yanukovych protests turned increasingly violent. but the mainstream U.S. press, in line with State Department guidance, has sought to minimize or dismiss the key role played by neo-Nazis in these, quote, self-defense forces, as well as in the new government. At most, you'll see references to these neo-Nazis as Ukrainian nationalists. However, as resistance to Kiev's right-wing regime expanded in the ethnic Russian east and south, the coup regime found itself unable to count on regular Ukrainian troops to fire on civilians. Thus, its national security chief, Andriy Poruby, himself a neo-Nazi, turned to the extensive... Poruby? I think it's just Poruby. Andriy Poruby, himself a neo-Nazi, turned to the intensely motivated neo-Nazi shock troops who had been battle-tested during the coup. These extremists were reorganized as special units of the National Guard and dispatched to the east and south to do the dirty work that the regular Ukrainian military was unwilling to do. Many of these extreme Ukrainian nationalists lionized World War II Nazi collaborator Stepan Bandera, and like Bandera, dream of a racially pure Ukraine, free of Jews, ethnic Russians, and other, quote, inferior beings. The slur of calling the Odessa protesters Colorado Beatles, as they were being burned alive, was a reference to the black and red colors used by the ethnic Russian resistance in the East. Though the mainstream U.S. press either described Poruby simply as the interim government's chief of national security with no further context, or possibly as a nationalist, his further background includes his founding of the Social National Party of Ukraine in 1991, blending radical Ukrainian nationalism with neo-Nazi symbols. Last year, he became commandant of the Maidan's self-defense forces. Then, on April 15th, after becoming the Kiev regime's chief of national security and finding Ukrainian troops unwilling to fire on fellow Ukrainians in the east, Poruby went on Twitter to announce, quote, Reserve unit of National Guard formed Maidan self-defense volunteers was sent to the front lines this morning. Those National Guard forces also were reported on the ground in Odessa when the trade union's building was torched on May 2nd, and they showed up again in Mariupol as the police station was burned on May 9th, according to a report in the New York Times on Saturday. The Times mentioned the appearance and then disappearance of the National Guard without providing any useful background about this newly organized force. In the language used by the mainstream U.S. press and the Kiev regime, the neo-Nazi brigades are, quote, volunteers and self-defense units, while the rebels resisting the post-coup regime are pro-Russian militants or terrorists. The Times reported the May 9th attack in Mariupol this way, quote, Ukraine, this is the New York Times now, Ukraine's interior minister, Avakov, wrote on Facebook that about 60 pro-Russian militants had tried to seize the city's police headquarters. The police called for support from the Ukrainian National Guard, a newly formed force of quickly trained volunteers drawn from participants in last winter's street protests in the capital. Mr. Avakov wrote that that 20 terrorists, quote, unquote, had died in the fighting, while those who survived dispersed and hid in a residential neighborhood. The Times added, quote, The National Guard, though, pulled out of the city soon afterward. Residents who had gathered around the police station offered an account that differed from the interior minister's. The city police, they said, were sympathetic to the pro-Russian side and had mutinied against an out-of-town chief newly installed by the interim government in Kiev. Quote, Armored vehicles had driven into the city to confront the rebellious police, not the militants, residents said. Holes in the brick wall suggested heavy weaponry. Gunfire echoed downtown. After the deaths inside the Mariupol police station, the Kiev regime rejoiced at the extermination of a large number of, quote, terrorists. As the UK's Independent reported, quote, the military action is accompanied by stridingly aggressive rhetoric from politicians in Kiev who are crowing about the number of, quote, terrorists killed and threatening further lethal punishment. The Kiev regime's concern that some local police forces have at best mixed loyalties has led it again to turn to the Maidan, quote, self-defense forces to serve as a special, quote, Kiev 1 police force, which was dispatched to Odessa amid that city's recent violence. And as we've read in the media in the past, especially in the European press, there are neo-Nazis from all over Europe who are going to Ukraine to see what they can do to help out, joining up these groups, Right Sector and C-14 and the other Hitler worshippers. It's unreal, isn't it? It's like a freaking Twilight Zone. And I know the Americans have backed Nazis all over the place. And that's, you know, this is what he goes on. I guess I'll leave it there because Perry goes on to tell the history of, you know, of course, the U.S. government has always backed Nazis since the end of World War II. They brought in Reinhard Gehlen to be the head of the CIA in the East. He was the head of the Soviet division of the CIA to start after World War II. Hitler's head of intelligence. The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. Ever read that one in the old Covert Action Quarterly? Or hell, just look at Trading with the Enemy, the Nazi American money plot. Talk about blowing your socks off. And then, of course, the entire history of Latin America is the history of backing fascists, the U.S. government backing. As Karl Rove called them. I don't know why it was Karl Rove who coined this phrase. Was it really him? Who talked about, I think he was talking about Obama, but he just talked about the mirrored sunglasses, fascist colonels and whatever. That's how Ted Rall draws Obama, too. In a full, like, you know, admiral getup with 100 little medals and ribbons and tassels and whatever. That's how I would draw him if I could draw. All right. Well, Patrick Coburn is coming up here in just a minute to talk about American support for the brutal dictatorship in Bahrain. And then later, it's possible. It is within the realm of possibility that our good old friend Doug Bandow from Cato and Forbes will be on the show to talk about Nigeria, perhaps, and or Ukraine. Oh, but in the last minute here, let me just say, so they had all these elections in the East, and they didn't vote to outright secede. They voted for independence in eastern Ukraine, and they didn't really define that. So that could mean a federalism type of system, you know, like states in a federal union. Or it could mean secession and absorption into the Russian Federation. All depends on how it's played in the West, which means, I guess, worst case scenario is most likely.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com, or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by scotthorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at scotthorton.org or go to scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here weekdays from 3 to 5 Eastern at APSRadioNews.com. And a lot of other places, too. ScottHorton.org. And our guest today is the great Patrick Coburn from The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. He's Middle East correspondent there. The author of quite a few books, including Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and The Future of Iraq. And you can find, I guess, pretty much all of his stuff for The Independent reprinted at UNS.com as well. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. Very happy to have you back. And a very important article here. Not only is it very informative and very well done, but it's on a topic that gets hardly any recognition or coverage at all, and that is the situation in Bahrain, which is a little tiny island nation in the Persian Gulf, where America stations the Fifth Fleet and supports the local monarchy there. So before we get to the royalty in the UK and their relationship with the royalty in Bahrain, can you first of all just tell us a little bit about Bahrain and the ruling family and how it works there?
Well, you said Bahrain's a pretty small place, but it's also a very divided place. In fact, I've never been in a place so full of hatred. And the hatred is between the Shia majority, about 60, 70% of the population, which really doesn't have any power and is ruled by the Al-Khalifa kings, monarchs, who are Sunni. There is continual discrimination against the Shia. The protests they held in 2011 for democratic reforms were crushed with incredible brutality. Saudi Arabia sent 1,500 soldiers. There's a causeway linking Bahrain to the mainland of Saudi Arabia. And things haven't got much better since. At that time, doctors in the hospital who treated injured demonstrators were savagely tortured. There was briefly an inquiry into what was happened, which confirmed everything, denied that there was any evidence of any Iranian involvement, which is what the kings are always saying, monarch is always saying. There we are today with basically a very oppressive regime, a majority that holds demonstrations, riots, but can't do a lot about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, there's so many things to touch on here. I guess, first of all, can you tell me anything about the Fifth Fleet and what all that entails? That could be anything from a couple of battleships to a couple of carrier battle groups, as far as I know.
Yeah, this is the main U.S. base in the Gulf, and it's in Bahrain. It's just outside Manama, the capital. The U.S. is always pretty shifty about Bahrain because Britain and as well, because there they're both countries are accusing President Bashar al-Assad of Syria of crushing an uprising by his people by holding total power over them. And hold on a minute, if we feel so strongly about that, why are we supporting the Al-Khalifa dynasty in Bahrain, which discriminates against the Shia, which is an absolute monarchy, and you hear pretty well nothing out of Washington or London. So this seems to me the height of hypocrisy.
Yeah, you know, I remember back when, in fact, I just found this recently, the transcript is still online, from Meet the Press, when David Gregory back in 2011 asked Admiral Mullen, who at that time, I forget if he was the head of CENTCOM or the director of national intelligence. Anyway, same difference for this point. And David Gregory asked him, well, you say that, you know, we're overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi in Libya because we care so much about human rights and you know, against dictatorship and that kind of thing. But how come we don't take that same position in Bahrain? And Mullen said simply, Bahrain is our ally. And so... In other words, our interests there are in propping up the monarchy. And so the majority of the people there who feel oppressed under the thumb of that dictatorship, to hell with them.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's about the size of it.
Yeah, at least he was honest about it, kind of, although it sort of put the lie to what he was claiming was his motivation or America's motivation for the intervention in Libya at the very same time. I mean, in this case, as you're saying, it's a minority dictatorship, what we'd be calling apartheid, I guess, if it was different races instead of different religious sects. But it's minority dictatorship over, I guess, a majority or even a supermajority of the population of the country, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this sort of hypocrisy, you know, is a theme throughout, I think, Western policy in the Middle East, that if you look at Syria, there we are protesting against and trying to overthrow Assad. He says a dictatorship. That's true. That there was a popular uprising. That's kind of true, or at least was. You know, and who are our big allies to do it? Well, it's, you know, the biggest, the most reactionary absolute monarchy in the world. Saudi Arabia, assisted by many monarchs like Bahrain, like United Arab Emirates. I mean, they don't come less democratic than these countries. They don't come less sectarian, for that matter. And yet we're trying to supposedly establish a democratic secular state in Syria, you know. So this is kind of absurd. It's the self-interest of the countries who want to overthrow Assad, which is determines their policy, not any feeling for the Syrian people.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to get back to Syria here in a minute, Patrick, but on Bahrain, do I remember right that back in 2011, the protesters were actually not pushing their luck too hard, and they started out just saying they would like to have some kind of constitutional reform, not to necessarily overthrow the monarchy, because not that they were for monarchy necessarily, but they didn't. It seemed at least at first they didn't want to push their luck, but they thought, well, maybe we could get some kind of constitutional monarchy where we would have some sort of process in law for, you know, fair trials, this kind of thing. The beginnings of a pretense of rule of law, basically. And that was what was crushed so harshly there in the Pearl Roundabout in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, the Pearl Roundabout was the center. The Pearl was meant to be the symbol of Bahrain, and there was a big monument with a sort of a pearl, and it was actually made out of an enormous pearl at the top of the monument. And not only was it the demonstration crushed, but the whole monument was bulldozed immediately afterwards. Although the same monument at that time appeared on the Bahraini currency. It must be the only country in the world where a government has destroyed the symbol of its own country, which is the currency it used.
Yeah. Well, we keep our symbols, but we destroy all the things that the symbols stand for here in our country. But I can relate, though, in a perverse kind of way.
Yeah.
All right, now, so what about Iranian agents? Because I have to admit that it makes sense that politicians in Iran, Revolutionary Guards officers in Iran, that they would seem to have some kind of interest in helping Shiites sort of exiled across the straits there in Bahrain, helpless before this Saudi and American-backed Sunni monarchy. So is it true that they're intervening, or that's just a...
Well, there was a something called the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, actually called together in a brief spasm of liberalism never seen before or since by the Bahraini government in 2011, had very sort of distinguished members led by an American Egyptian lawyer and legal expert called Basuni. And they produced an enormous report, 500 pages. And one thing they didn't find was any evidence of Iranian involvement. So it's just not there. I was looking actually at WikiLeaks, American diplomatic cables from a slightly earlier period, sort of 2008, that era. And the American diplomats in Bahrain are saying every time we meet the king, King Hamad, and every time we meet senior Bahrainis, they say, the Iranians are plotting against us. They're behind opposition to the monarchy. And we, this is the American diplomat speaking, always say, show us some evidence. And they never have any evidence. I mean, anybody can look, put in Bahrain and WikiLeaks, and that'll come up pretty soon.
Yeah.
So, but these people did get themselves into a great state of paranoia. I think it's true of dictatorships throughout the world. People who ban all criticism of themselves, that when they suddenly start looking at the internet and so forth, or they see people demonstrating in the streets, it's they overreact. They sort of think this is the revolution coming. And then they sort of act, so they make much more of a revolutionary situation out of what might be a reforming movement than was there before. Same thing true of Syria, by the way. I think overreaction to the initial demonstrations, which was what really put the uprising on the road in 2011. And in Bahrain, they did exactly the same thing. They crushed these demonstrations with immense brutality and tortured anybody they could really get their hands on. And of course, like many torturers who believe in a great conspiracy against themselves by the Iranians, by the Shia, when they find no evidence of it, despite torturing people, it means that that conspiracy must be even worse than we thought.
Right.
Because all these guys are keeping silent about it. They must be highly trained about, you know, resisting interrogation. So we're going to torture them more, and we're going to torture more people. You know, that's the way these guys think. That's the way all dictatorships work.
Yeah. Oh, man. And then on top of that, as you write here, more than 30 Shia mosques bulldozed. There's some hard feelings that aren't going to be better again for a long time. Now, I'm sorry, Patrick, I got to put you on hold as we go out and take this break. But I'll thank you for holding. And when we get back, everybody, more with Patrick Coburn on Bahrain and Syria, too, after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. In the middle of talking with the great Patrick Coburn from The Independent in London. That's independent.co.uk. He's Middle East correspondent there. He's the author of the book Muqtada. And this piece is called Prince Andrew Praises Bahrain, Island of Torture. And I think, Patrick, this will be the closest we ever get to royal gossip on this show, but I think it's instructive. The same reason I think that you chose to write about Prince Andrew here, of just what we're caught up in, what this imperialism looks like, you know, to those who have to see it up close on the receiving end there. Could you tell us a little bit about Prince Andrew and the scandal around his recent visits to Bahrain?
Yeah, Andrew is a Duke of York, in a circle of the royal family. He's always had a relationship with Bahrain. He's always been going there. Now, just recently, despite there's been very few places in the world that hasn't been had it up in lights that torture goes on there as much as Bahrain. You know, if you look at the UN reports on it, the UN rapporteur on torture, who, by the way, is excluded permanently from the island. Even the U.S. State Department says that this is a country that no political change can take place peacefully, that people are put in jail on the vaguest charges, and people are tortured. And, of course, all the human rights groups like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, say the same thing. But this didn't deter Andrew from last month announcing that he was going to be the guest speaker on a sort of conference on Bahrain in London, which is to show what a tolerant, nice, religiously diverse, free place Bahrain is. I mean, this is a complete PR venture on the part of Bahrain. Theoretically, or it's meant to be given by the Bahrain Expatriates Association, but although the opposition suspect that the government is behind it somewhere. Now, Andrew has a history as regards Bahrain, rather a funny one, actually. He was always going there, but exactly what was happening there was revealed. A former British diplomat wrote a few years ago, saying that the British diplomats in Bahrain regarded Andrew as a complete bore, as a rude, self-regarding. And he cites various examples of this. He always traveled in style. He always brought a valet with him. The valet carried an ironing board, because even when staying in five-star hotels, Andrew liked his trousers to be creased exactly right, and he needed a valet with an ironing board to do this, you know, so you can't make this stuff up.
This is what defines high society, that makes people like him better than people like us, right?
Yeah, I mean, even sort of by the lowly standards of the British royal family, I mean, this is pretty appalling, you know, yeah, his behavior. But, you know, why does he do it? Well, this diplomat thought it was a sort of inferiority complex. Actually, I think it's a much simpler reason, that there you have somebody like the Duke of York, who's kind of a pretend sort of prince, pretend king. And suddenly what he'd really like to do is have authority over people. He'd like to have power, you know, like kings 500 years ago in Britain. And that he really likes the idea of rubbing shoulders with the King of Bahrain or the royalty in Kuwait or United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia. This gives him a thrill, but this is what he'd really like to do himself.
That's funny. And of course, the real punchline is Britain is only the ridiculous junior partner in this empire now. It's not even the British Empire over there anymore. So, you know, even when it comes to the Middle East, it's never mind 500 years ago. He's, you know, at least going back to last century, trying to find a time when what Britain said was what went over there rather than what America says.
I think there's that, but I'm not sure. I think it's even just simpler. I think it's just personal aggrandizement, you know, that likes to feel he has real power.
Yeah. And, well, you know, for me, the fact that, I guess, I don't know, Patrick, maybe I shouldn't take the American Revolution so seriously, but I sort of kind of do, the republicanism as a improvement upon monarchy and that kind of thing. And yet, the fact that Uncle Sam, the U.S. government, backs every king and sultan and emir and so-called president and self-appointed potentate over there in the Middle East is a real thing of mine. Like, it's, you know, supporting...
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Scott. I think that, you know, these elites, you know, the 1%, what they'd really like is the 1% not only to have all the money, but have all the power. They really don't like this. Whatever they say, they really don't like democracy. They don't like other people having a say. They don't like other people having a share. And I think that's why, you know, the Bushes got on so well with these Prince Bandar and the Saudis. You know, they love these guys. Now, some of them, of course, are just paid off. You know, it's just cash in the bank. But for others, I think it's a thrill of seeing what they would like to be, which is completely in control.
Yep. Well, and then for the American people to not get it and believe the hype about American support for democracy while all this is going on is just sort of the adding the insult to injury at the end. But back to the injury here, can we talk about Homs and the government of Syria moving back into Homs and the rebels fleeing? Yeah. I guess I saw one or two reports that said that, well, yeah, but where are they going to go? They're moving back toward the Iraqi border, and now those forces are reinforced and we'll be able to claim that much more territory in other places, just playing whack-a-mole kind of a thing. What do you think?
To a degree, yeah. I mean, Assad is succeeding in the center of the country, Homs, around Damascus, in that area. And the 1,200 fighters, gunmen, have moved out of the old city of Homs. They've moved sort of north, probably towards Aleppo or further east. So, you know, the old city's in ruins. What happens now? There's more fighting in Aleppo. A rather peculiar situation has happened there, actually. About 10 days ago, the opposition, the rebels there, of the east of the city, they control the pumping stations for the fresh water, for the drinking water, and they were trying to turn off the drinking water in the government-held section. But somehow they pushed the wrong button or twisted the wrong valve, and they managed to turn off all the drinking water at all of Aleppo, including the areas held by themselves. So in Aleppo now, there are queues of women and children everywhere, you know, with kettles and pots and pans, filling it with water from fountains or wells, you know, outside the mosques or anywhere else. It's pretty polluted water, but it's that or nothing. So, you know, it's still a pretty, pretty ruinous situation for the Syrian people.
Mm. Well, now, I don't know if there's really kind of any grand design or even just plain old design to American policy over there in the Middle East, but it does seem like there's a real effort and real optimism about striking an Iran nuclear deal. And I know that's still only a first step, but it seems like since that is the huge, albeit fake, outstanding issue between the U.S. and Iran, that maybe that could really mean a real beginning to the end of the Cold War with Iran. And then that changes the whole so-called logic or of the crisis of the Iran-backed Shiite crescent, right? Redoes all the so-called calculus, as all the geniuses in D.C. like to call it, about who does what and how bad it matters. Like, for example, who cares if Assad is still the rule? I mean, who in the empire cares whether Assad rules Damascus as long as he's not Iran's kingpin in Damascus?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot in that. I think, you know, if there is a deal, an agreement with Iran, then Iran, and then the negotiations over Syria or talks and Iran is there, mm-hmm. then a lot of things can happen. Earlier in the year, when we had the Geneva II talks and John Kerry was saying, Iran can't be there until they agree that this is transition, that Assad is going, which was ludicrous because Assad holds 13 out of 14 of the provincial capitals of Syria. He's kind of winning at the moment. Why should he go? So if you say that, you're basically saying this war can go on. You know, you may look as though you are holding a peace conference, but actually it's kind of, in a way, a war conference. And that's what's happened. You can only really bring an end to this war by all the players being there. I mean, the US, Russia, but also Iran and Saudi Arabia and perhaps Turkey. Everybody has to be there because so many people are involved in the Syrian disaster at this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think anyone on the American or the Western side will try to take advantage of the opportunity created by the Iran nuclear deal to then, you know, move forward with something like trying to work out a peace in Syria?
I don't know. I think they equivocate because this has not gone well for them. This was meant to be one in the eye. You know, this is meant to damage Iran. This was meant to damage Hezbollah. This was meant to damage Russia. Actually, they're all going to emerge stronger from this. Mm. I mean, my feeling, Scott, is that in 2011, a lot of people, including the U.S. and Washington, the West European states, the Saudis, the others, they all got very high up the tree saying Assad is going to go tomorrow. You know, if you look at the quotes of what they were saying then, 2011, early 2012. So Assad's still there, regardless of what he does, is kind of a humiliation for them. I mean, this isn't what they said was going to happen. They've sort of suffered a defeat, and they just don't want to admit that. So you have these sort of pretend negotiations, which they say Assad must go. Why should he go? And, you know, then you can argue whether he's good or bad, but that doesn't really enter into it. I mean, he's going to stay for the moment. And so I think there's a great sort of amount of hypocrisy in the outside world by pretending that the supporters of the rebels are looking for a peace. Well, really, they're quite sort of reasonably happy for the war to go on.
Right. Yeah, they were just telling McClatchy newspapers the other day, when they were talking about sending TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles, to even more groups over there, that just as long as they can, you know, basically paraphrasing the Israelis, that as long as they can just keep the war going, make sure they don't want to help the rebels win. They just want to make sure that there are rebels still. And as long as they can, you know, keep them active, then that's the status quo that they seek to maintain.
Yeah, a weak Syria, and it's not too humiliating for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of not very low-level war. I mean, the numbers of refugees, they're saying 9 million refugees or 9 million displaced. That's more than Iraq, internal and external displaced, if those numbers are right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's great cynicism about this. And that goes on. All these people, they stay in the refugee camps. More refugees are created. And this isn't to say that, you know, a lot of these people are created terminal refugees by bombs being dropped from Assad's helicopters. But, you know, if one's saying, how could this war end? then, you know, the record of the U.S. and the outside powers is really pretty bad. They've stoked it. They're keeping it going.
Right. All right, everybody. That is the great Patrick Coburn. Thank you so much for your time on the show again, Patrick. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Enjoyed it.
All right, everybody, that is the great Patrick Coburn. He is at the Independent, that's independent.co.uk. He's the author of the book, Muqtada. You got to read that book. Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia Revival and the Future of Iraq. And he's at uns.com. Check out Prince Andrew Praises Bahrain, Island of Torture. And check out his five-part series on the new rise of al-Qaeda, the third, fourth generation of al-Qaeda fighters in Iraq and Syria. They're at the Independent and at uns.com. And we're way overdue to play a Fox News, so plug your ears.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Well, Lord have mercy. I can't believe it. I cannot believe what I'm reading. Could this really be true? I do feel like I'm living in the Twilight Zone. Got America back in kings and Nazis, and now a former Austin police detective is expected to be indicted by a Travis County grand jury for the murder of a black man. Jackson was his name, Larry Jackson Jr., who did nothing. And the cop hunted him down and murdered him. Of course, he ought to be going to prison for first-degree murder for the rest of his life. But the fact that he is being indicted and could be tried over this, that is just unreal. You know, I try very hard not to do, you know, the correlation causation mistake. Cherry picking out my evidence and whatever. We're all susceptible to that. But dare I suggest that the tide is beginning to turn? That now, I don't know about a majority, but at least such a substantial plurality of regular, decent, law-abiding, non-criminal people in this society hate the cops so much that they are beginning to have to back down a little bit. The prosecutors are beginning to have to find expendable ones to sacrifice, raw meat to throw to the bang mob. I sure hope so. Especially when we have a problem of so many, hey, millions of soldiers coming home from the wars where they've been patrolling civilians. They haven't been fighting the German Wehrmacht out on the plains of France or something. They have been patrolling civilians in their neighborhoods with their finger on the trigger. For years, millions of them. And that's where the cops get their guys from. And now, you know, yes, it's true that there are some, you know, former soldiers. Everyone's an individual. There are people who could understand very well that their role is supposed to be protecting the lives even of their very most criminal suspects. Protecting the rights of their very most criminal suspects. That is their obligation, supposedly. That's the theory of the job, and there are people who can act that way, or at least try to. But that's not the way they're trained. Not anymore. They're trained to treat us all as enemies. They're trained to treat us all as Faludjans, and they're the occupying army. And so, try being in that environment, and all dressed up like a special forces soldier too, and not act that way. So, I don't know. It's gotten way, way, way out of control. It's so far out of control, it's just incredible. And you go start reading what Radley Balka writes there at the Washington Post now. Praise whatever deity you believe in for Balka having a job at the Post. Holy crap. That is amazing. And I don't know if... they got to publish them in the paper sometimes. They publish them online. But anyway, go read him for a while and it'll just... Man, it's sad what they do to people. Read Will Grigg. Day in, day out. You know, there's 100 SWAT raids a day in America. And not all of those end up in accidental shootings of innocent people, but a lot of them do. And a lot of them end up in completely changing people's lives. You know, everybody heard that story about, can you believe the cops handcuffed a 9-year-old girl? Oh, yeah, cluck your tongue. I think that one might have even gotten around to some water coolers at the office. They handcuffed a 9-year-old girl for a little slap fight with her little schoolmate 2 days before? And what? Oh, and she was black, so she had that much less rights. The cops are bound to respect, of course. And you know what they leave out, though, was that her grandmother says that now she's a different person. She was such a bright, happy, sweet little girl. She was such an accomplished little girl and doing well in all of the advanced classes at school and all this. Now she's a wreck. Now she's in therapy and now she's on a downer, man. It's the worst thing that ever happened to her in her whole life and probably for a long time to come till the next time the cops get their hands on her. Ruined her life. Anyway, that's how they are. And so, I'm not saying I'm satisfied. I want them all indicted. I think every cop should be up on the gallows with the burden of proof on them to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt why they're not a guilty murderer felon. They're all guilty until found innocent. After the burden is on them beyond a shadow of a doubt to prove it, which is how they treat us all day, every day. So, it's not like we're done or anything. But on the other hand, man, that's positive, isn't it? What do you think, chat room guys? Chat room. King Felix says, was this black man a lawyer, a doctor, a professor? No, actually, I don't think so. I think he was just a guy from the East Side without a profession. He was just a guy. Here's what happened. He went to a bank that was closed because it had just been robbed. Or, I don't know, just been robbed. It had been robbed earlier that day. But he didn't know that, so he went and he tried to open the door. But it was locked. So then apparently, he went and looked in the window and tried to knock on the door. Hey, what's going on in there? I got some business I'm trying to take care of here. But there was a cop in there. Or the cop was outside in his car or something. And the bank employee alerted the cop. Oh no, a black guy. So the cop went to go and oppress him, and nobody knows exactly what happened at that point, but the guy took off running. He didn't attack the cop. He just took off running down 34th Street. He got down to the bottom of the hill there by the Shoal Creek Bridge, and I guess was trying to hide from the cop under the bridge or something. The cop chased him down under the bridge, and then they fought, and the cop shot him in the back of the head. Well, they say the back of the neck, but... So I don't know if... He, put him on his knees and made him cry out for Jesus first, or if he even gave him a chance or what, but he murdered him. And the guy wasn't a criminal. He was just some guy going to do business at the bank. He hadn't done anything at all wrong. He was not the bank robber. And the bank robber was not a black guy, so he was not couldn't possibly have been the suspect. Because usually when you're talking bank robbers, the race of the bank robber is made into a big deal in the first descriptions that the cops get. If the eyewitnesses can get one thing right, usually it's whether it was a black guy or a white guy, right? I could see maybe if they got confused between Korean and Japanese. No offense, guys. I'm just saying, if you were a bank teller and you weren't Asian and the robber was in a real hurry and your heart was really pounding and you hadn't really had a chance to think for a minute whether maybe he was Japanese or Korean, you might slip up. But no, in this case, the bank was robbed by a white guy. They knew that. And anyway, so the cop murdered him, and now they're saying he will be indicted. I don't know. They got the grand jury to agree to that yesterday, but they didn't vote yet. I don't know how that works exactly. I guess the kids are trying to sue the city about it. And anyway, so, I don't know. If a cop killed you, do you think that the prosecutor would indict him? That should be the question of the day on the show. Hey, if the cop murdered you, you know, because he felt like it, do you think that the rule of law would apply to the cop and that he would go to prison for murder? Right, I know, it's stupid, right? That would be a waste of all of our time to just take 100 no calls in a row. Nobody thinks that if the cops murdered them, they would be held accountable. And it's going to take 100 of these to change the way people think about it. They've had such impunity for so long. And, you know, I remember not very long ago, actually, man, you guys might have heard of this, too. I heard him on NPR. They interviewed the district attorney in Dallas. And he was just a new generation. He was a black guy. So, new race, new generation of law degree, not connected to the old regime, really. He came in from outside somehow, or he just was a citizen who got elected. He did not rise up through the ranks of the DA's office, I don't believe. And he just came in and said, no hard feelings. We're not seeking to, you know, go back and prosecute old prosecutors or anything like that. However, meh. We don't feel any special obligation of continuity between the previous district attorney's regimes and the current one. And we are now going to set up a division that's going to go back and review all of our convictions, and we're going to see whether there's really reason to believe that these people did what they did. Because the Dallas Police Department has done things wrong for a long, long time. Of course, it was a huge scandal. All the guys who were just framed up with sheetrock dust. Framed up with wallboard powder. They called it cocaine, and they did this to hundreds of people. I don't know, scores, anyway. So this district attorney has gone back and said, hey, let's go back. Hey, whatever, man. I don't care about the old guy. Nobody's mad here. We just want to know what's going on, so let's go back through and let's see if the people we've convicted really did it or not. And if we don't think that they really did it, let's go ahead and work to get them out. Oh, my God. Isn't that crazy? Just to even say that that has happened in America. That a DA has come and said, open up every file cabinet in here. And we're triple checking it, boys. To think that that could happen in America. It's unreal. It's unbelievable. It's heroic. And still, no accountability for the conspirators who did it wrong all along. Now you're talking comic book land.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. The number's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If you want to call in and talk about this, that, or the other thing, you know how it goes. Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Guantanamo, police state stuff, drone wars, and media hatred, and economics, too, if you want to talk about that. I don't care, man. Whatever you want. 512-271-4836. That's not how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to have a question of the day. Who do you hate more? Cops or the politicians who hire them? And why? I know, me too. I hate them both more than each other. All right, well, we covered Syria with Patrick here. Let me move on. My own news here. Iraq. Deadly bombings sweep Iraq after army shelling in Fallujah. Medical officials say 14 killed in attacks in Dujail, Dawar, and Tarmia. Day after army killed 11 in Fallujah. And so there you go, the whole civil war. I mean, that's in The Guardian. You guys can look it up. But this goes on day after day after day. Antiwar.com/updates. That's where Margaret Griffiths compiles all the dead in Iraq still. And this is the American war still being carried out there. And there's no end in sight. I mean, the recent elections in Iraq are basically, some kind of formality, because there's no one organized to defeat Maliki. And, last time, Alawi and his coalition just barely won, which is amazing. That Maliki is so bad, the Americans, fifth choice to be dictator there, was so bad that their third choice to be dictator there, second choice, Iyad Alawi, the former CIA agent, truck bomber, prisoner executor, and sock puppet dictator from 03 through 04 there, he actually won in 2010. I always say 09, don't I? I'm sorry, guys. It was 2010, the elections of the spring of 2010. And he put together, it was a plurality, not a majority, but he still beat Maliki pretty soundly. And under the Constitution, that was it. Alawi was the guy. But then Obama went ahead and backed Maliki anyway. And so that was the way it worked out, was Maliki won anyway. And since then, he's completely frozen the Sunnis out. And plus, the American-backed Sunni jihad in Syria next door has re-energized our old enemies in the Sunni jihad in Iraq. So they see less and less incentive to wait around for things to change when they feel like they've got momentum behind them. And of course, this only benefits Maliki politically, because he doesn't want to be the president of all Iraqis. He wants to be the president of the Shiites. And so if he can be the protector, even if he fails to protect, if he's the monopoly on the right to protect Shiites from Sunni suicide bombers, then blam, he's rehired. And as a couple of pretty informed wonky types were saying the other day, and some things that I read, there's no reason to believe that they'll have elections in Iraq after this. Maliki's not going anywhere now. You had the election of 05 where the Sunnis just boycotted it. You had the election of 10. They have another one in there? No, 7 or something? I forget. You had another one in 10 where the Sunnis participated but were frozen out anyway. And then now this year, 2014, again, the Sunnis are just completely frozen out of the process. They didn't even boycott it because they didn't have a chance to boycott it because there were no polling stations in the Anbar province. And so really, the other thing of it is too, as Patrick Coburn was explaining on our show, the end of last summer, right? That the Iraqi army had withdrawn from Anbar too, from some places up in Mosul. I guess they've sort of tried to lay siege to Fallujah for now. But the fact that they had withdrawn back then due to just lack of reinforcements or authority, they were just sitting around, as targets and not accomplishing anything else, just goes to show. And in fact, the siege of Fallujah proves the same point, too, that they're basically the Iraqi army that the U.S. trained up is helpless to control Western Iraq. So, that's the Yanan plan again. The Israeli clean break policy in practice. All right. Well, so here's a question for you. I don't know, man. You guys, this segment's almost over now. Maybe in the next segment, if anybody wants to talk about Iran. There's this article here about how the negotiations maybe have hit a sticking point, in that the Americans have always been kind of pie in the sky about just how many centrifuges they can get the Iranians. After all, it is a big fake issue. And after all, the Iranian Revolution, which they had the right to overthrow the Shah, for Christ's sake. To argue otherwise, you would have to argue that America had the right to reinstall the Shah Reza Pahlavi fascist military dictator. Right, yeah, exactly. So, And anyway, I know it was your dictator that they overthrew and that it got your feelings all hurt and all that. However, now, that was back when I was a toddler. And now I got all these gray hairs in Iran. They are never going to let 1953 play itself out in Tehran again. And if they really thought the 2009 Green Revolution would have led to the fall of the Ayatollah and all that, the Revolutionary Guard would have massacred those people in the streets. There is no way they're going to let 1953 coup d'etat happen again there. And there ain't no way the American people or even the U.S. Army is going to allow a full-scale invasion, bombing, regime change of that country. So, destroy work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Did you see that the Israelis were accusing Jeff Stein of anti-Semitism? Oh, my goodness. Again, advice to the empire. People can see through your baseless accusations inside the American intelligence community. And he's the kind of guy who, hey, if he's got good journalism to write about Israeli spying in America, then he's going to write it. In fact, maybe the fact that he's Jewish kind of helps him to shield from accusations that this is some anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Because, well, that would just sound stupid if someone accused him of anti-Semitism, right? Since he's a liberal American Jew, he's clearly not anti-Semitic. And, you know, I had him on the show the other day, and he didn't say anything bad about Jews at all. Yeah, for some reason. What he said was, the Israeli government spies on American businesses and the American government all day, every day, and they don't quit. And they don't stop. They keep on. That's what he said. That's just journalism. You know, I talked to a guy named John Cole on this show back when. And Jeff Stein, I think what got everybody mad was that he writes for Newsweek. Now, he used to write for Congressional Quarterly. I don't know his whole history, but back when he wrote for Congressional Quarterly, that's a very acceptable mainstream publication, no doubt about it. He's a very mainstream acceptable guy, writing at a very high level national intelligence beat kind of a thing. But his stories never really got out all that far. Remember the whole thing about Jane Harmon? That'd take me a whole segment to tell you that convoluted mess, but she's a compromised. The follow-up by Jeff Stein, Israel's aggressive spying in the U.S. mostly hushed up. And then here was that article in the Times of Israel, which is, I don't think this is the Sheldon Adelson one, is it? I don't know. I think it's pretty right-leaning. An Israeli spy hid in Al Gore's hotel room is one of them. Awesome. What a great assignment. And that's all they ever want to do. And you know what? Especially, like, you listen to Phil Giraldi. He's kind of grumpy. But that and I mean that in a nice way. But Ray McGovern is such an old softy, right? He's such an old dove. He's such a sweet, old, grandfatherly old guy. And, man, you get him started on Israel, and he just... And he don't get mad at them, but he just can't wait to educate you about what you need to know about what they're really up to. And something else, man, I think Ketchum really nailed it. Scratch an intelligence officer and he'll start complaining about Israeli spying in the United States of America. That's a counterpunch.org for you there. All right, so none of y'all are going to call in. You make me look like such a jerk. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. This is Scott Horton Show, where I sit around giving out the phone number and nobody calls in. I know you're out there. There's a whole chat room full of people, and that couldn't possibly be more than some of the listeners. Owning at the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, guys. Welcome back to the dang thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Quit your crying, Ken. Actually killing people each and every single day. Hey, it's a big continent. And anyway, this article is by Jamoke Balogun, a Nigerian-American who lives, I guess, here in the U.S. And I tried to get her on the show, but I didn't hear back. Maybe I'll get her on later in the week. But Doug Bandow also wrote a great piece, Who Can Save Our... I'm not an anarchist, you know, purist, because I don't think that's really his interest so much. But he is a libertarian. He's at Cato and at Forbes, and he's... I get the idea. He's not all that ideological. He's much more issues-based. So he can talk at length and in-depth about Asian issues, for example, and really get to the heart of things. Really great guy. Really great mind. Wrote for antiwar.com for a long, long time as well. All right. So I had articles about cops, but it was just they murdered some guy. What was the other one? I forgot. Well, lots of guys getting murdered. You know, I put a bunch of anti-cop stuff up on Twitter, and I lost almost 10 followers. Just because I said that the police are the lowest form of life in the world, even lower than the politicians that they work for. Which I thought was a pretty non-controversial sort of statement of fact. Oh. All right. Well, I didn't do it right. You can try again if you want. Sorry I screwed that up. I hit the one button, but I was supposed to hit two. All right. Are you still there? Hello? Nope, you're gone. All right. Well, anybody else wants to call in or the same person again? 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. It wasn't you. It was me. But now it's fixed and it should work. If you want to call. All right, and then I guess I meant to recap about Ukraine anyway. So they had their elections over the weekend, and there were some ballots stolen. There were a bunch of people shot and massacred, the right sector guys, the so-called National Guard, just opened fire on a crowd. And then as I was explaining in this Robert Perry piece, they set fire to the building, still had a bunch of people in it. There was a video of them. Basically, it was like one group of yes ballots and one group of no ballots. Like they went in different boxes, so they just stole all the yes ballots and were running off with them. But still, super majorities voted for this new autonomy. So I don't know what difference it really makes on the ground. Nobody's going to respect it in Kiev or DC. But it might make matters worse in the short term. I guess we'll see what happens. There's a presidential election scheduled for the 25th. And, all right, hey, thanks for your patience with my idiocy, and thanks for calling back. How are you doing? Welcome to the show. Caller, you're on. Hey, dude. Now what? Oh, man. No way. I hit the thing. God dang it, Bobby. All right, well, I'm blaming AT&T for that one. Wait, was that my fault, too? That could have been my fault, too. I'm pretty sure that was AT&T's fault. It's no way to run a radio show. You're right. I should have a whole staff. I should have one guy to answer the phone, and one guy to run the board, and one guy to Google stuff for me when I can't remember where I found it. Actually, they should all be really sexy ladies. And I should make $1 million a year and have 1 million listeners a day. And also should a lot of other stuff. Oh, by the way, I saw this thing. I meant to talk about this earlier on the show. This is at bankruptingamerica.org. I don't know what that is. But it's called Five Things to Know About Millennial Political Attitudes. And I was happy to see that the young does millennials means what? Born between 95 and 05, something like that? Or how's that work? That's only half a generation anyway. I don't know exactly what a millennial is. But anyway, they say here that they don't believe in anything political-wise. They're very cynical, and they're not very trustworthy, and they're not disappointed because they never did believe in the first place, and I like that kind of thing. And then at the end, they're all a bunch of socialists, and they all think that the government should be in charge of everything to make everything fair and give everything to everyone, and then that way everyone will have a house and food and clothes and education. And yeah, they all still went to government school. Another generation of commies. At least they don't really believe. They just think so. But then the good news was, again, they don't believe. And they don't think that government spending is a good way to help the economy. And they do think that cutting their budget and cutting taxes is. So there's that. Their overall cynicism and apathy, I guess I have to endorse. Although, I wish they were more angry than apathetic, but, you know. I would just hate to see them get on board for some great movement like the next Obama for president or something and do us all harm and get their feelings hurt again. So better to stay disgruntled. Maybe they'll end up libertarian sooner or later. I don't know. All right. See you guys tomorrow. Thanks for listening.